Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 18th video of the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we'll begin looking at the individual historical books, starting with the book of Joshua. First, some background information. Joshua is the first of the historical books. It's still part of the continuous narrative which started in Genesis, and it's still part of the third historical epic of Exodus conquest, which narrates the transition of God's people from Egypt to the land of Israel. And as such, Joshua continues the fulfillment of the promises God gave to Abraham, specifically in this book, the promise that Abraham's descendants would possess and rule the promised land. There are two possible dates of the conquest itself. Remember from the book of Exodus that there are two possible dates for the Exodus. Well, the conquest of the promised land is 40 years after the Exodus. So those two possible dates of the conquest are calculated from the two possible dates of the Exodus. Feel free to examine the discussion in the course textbook if you want more information about the date of Joshua's conquest. The authorship of the book of Joshua is technically anonymous. The book itself does not claim who wrote it. Tradition has suggested Joshua, or possibly Samuel, or a few other possibilities. Now, much of the book clearly comes from an eyewitness, and Joshua 24:26 says that Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law of God. So Joshua himself wrote at least part of it, but we don't know if he wrote all of it. And when it was written is a mystery as well. In a few places, things are said to exist until this day, that is the day of its writing, which would put the date of the writing before the monarchy of Saul and David. See your textbook for more information about the date, if you'd like to pursue this further. And finally, the book of Joshua has proven historically trustworthy. There are some debates about the history and archaeology, but the best conclusion is that Joshua is historically accurate. Now let's look at the organization of the book of Joshua. There are four major sections of this book, based on the major events in each section. The first section is the introduction. Joshua and the people are preparing to enter and conquer the land. And in the second section, Israel conquers the land. They exercise warfare with God fighting on their behalf. There are three campaigns that defeat the armies of the nations living in the land. And then in the third section, the people divide up the land that they have conquered. Each of the 12 tribes gets a portion of the land allotted to them. And then in the last section, the 12 tribes take possession of their inheritance, and the people settle into their new home and begin dwelling in the land that the Lord their God had given them. Next is the content of the book of Joshua, beginning with some key verses. First, Joshua chapter 1, verses 3 through 9, which says, "I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. No one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Now, this passage is God's commission and command to Joshua. It reiterates the promises of Abraham to give them all the land, and it commands Joshua to be strong and courageous. And the central command is to keep the law on his heart and to obey it. And the promise is that he will succeed because God has given him success. Next is chapter 2, verses 9 through 11, which says, Rahab from Jericho speaking to the spies, she says, I know that Yahweh has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how Yahweh dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For Yahweh your God is God in heaven and on the earth below. See, in this passage, the fame of the Lord's name, which you recall from Exodus, he sought to spread to every nation through the Exodus. It had reached the people of Jericho, and they acknowledged that he is Yahweh. Now, most of the people feared because they opposed the Lord. But Rahab and her family responded to the report of the Lord by converting to his side and confessing that he is Yahweh. Then Joshua chapter 11, verse 23, which says, So Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses, and he gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal divisions. Then the land had rest from war. Now, this verse summarizes the obvious main idea from Joshua, that they conquered the promised land, and it became an inheritance to the people of Israel. Next, chapter 21, verses 43 through 45, which says, So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give to their forefathers, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their forefathers. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to the house of Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. Now, this passage restates the fact that they took possession of the land, but it emphasizes the completeness of their success because the Lord gave them success. And this was because the Lord was fulfilling his promises. Did you hear? It said all his promises were filled. Not a single one failed. None. Zero. Big fat goose egg. Now, we've seen on occasion many of God's promises, they're tested, and they sometimes appear like they would fail. But now we see very clearly that none of them actually did fail. And I want to make a big deal about this because I hope you'll take this to heart. In our own lives, God's word will be tested. Sometimes it might look like God will fail. It might appear that he will be unfaithful. But don't let appearances fool you. God's word will never fail. Now, of course, I need to caution that this applies to what God has actually promised in his word, not what we think he should do. We can't just sort of make up our own promises and expect God's going to fulfill them. But not one of his genuine promises will ever ever, ever disappoint. If it looks like it will, stay faithful and give him time, because he will not fail. Now let's move on to Joshua chapter 23, verses 6 through 16, which says, "Be very strong. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, without turning aside to the right or to the left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the name of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you are to hold fast to Yahweh your God, as you have until now. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you, just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. But if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your back and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land, which the Lord your God has given you. Now I'm about to go the way of all the earth. You know with all your heart and soul that not one of all the good promises the Lord your God gave you has failed. Every promise has been fulfilled. Not one has failed. But just as every good promise of the Lord your God has come true, so the Lord will bring on you all the evil he has threatened until he has destroyed you from the good land he has given you, if you violate the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them. The Lord's anger will burn against you, and you will quickly perish from the good land he has given you." Now, I know this is a longer passage, and there are many key ideas here. Again, the command to be strong, to obey the law. Do not compromise with the nations, but drive them out completely, because God is with you. And if you do compromise with them, they will be a snare to you, and God will not fight for you. And remember, not one of God's promises have failed. Every one has been fulfilled. Now, however, Joshua goes on, just like every promise for good is fulfilled, every threat of punishment for unfaithfulness will be filled as well. God will not fail here either. And I want you to take this to heart as well. Remember, we should love and fear God. We can never take obedience lightly. Don't show contempt for God's grace by presuming upon it. And trust his word to bless and his word to punish, because both will come true. And the next key verse is chapter 24, verses 14 and 15. Where Joshua is commissioning the people, and he says, "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshiped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve Yahweh. But if serving Yahweh seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're now living. But as for me and my household, we will serve Yahweh." This is Joshua's last commission to the people of Israel. And the heart of it is to serve Yahweh and none other. And he gives the famous line, "Even if you don't serve the Lord, I and my family will." And then the last key verse from Joshua is chapter 24, verse 31, which says, Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him, who had first experienced everything the Lord had done for Israel. Now, this is a bittersweet passage. On the one hand, it celebrates that the people faithfully served the Lord in Joshua's generation, and everything went so well. The book of Joshua is such a happy, joyful, success-filled book. But this verse also hints that this faithfulness may not continue into the next generation. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. That story will wait until we look at the book of Judges. For now, let's continue to look at the content of the book of Joshua. The first section of Joshua, which I have given the unimaginative label of introduction, it describes the preparations that Israel made to enter the land. And I've broken this section down into five C's. The first is the commission of Joshua. The commission is stated in such a way to draw attention to the most important item. And this is a common Hebrew way of communicating. It's technically called chiasm, but I call it the sandwich structure because it emphasizes the center item, like the meat in a sandwich. And I suggest you read along to see if this is true in chapter 1. It says, "Just like I was with Moses, I will be with you. I will not forsake you. I will not abandon you." Now compare this actually to Genesis 28, verse 15, where God promises to Jacob at Bethel, as Jacob was leaving the promised land, that God would be with him. He would not leave him. And then in Joshua, back to Joshua, next it says, "Be strong and courageous, because you will lead his people to inherit the land which I swore to your fathers to give to them. Only be strong and very courageous." Next it says, "Be careful to do just like all the Torah which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn aside from it to the right or to the left." Then it says the purpose, "so that you may be successful in everything or every place that you walk." And then the center, the meat of Joshua's commission is, "Do not let this book of Torah depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night. The word is to be in your mouth and your thoughts." And the result of this is that so that you will be careful to do just like all that is written in it. And then it repeats the purpose again. Your path will prosper and you will be successful. Then again it says, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be dismayed." Why? Again it says, "Because the Lord your God is with you in every place in which you walk." Now I hope you can see by the graphic way that it is laid out which items the author is emphasizing and how this fits together. Now, I wish we had time to walk through all of this means for all of us in our Christian life, but unfortunately, we need to press on. So I'll just leave this here for your prayerful consideration. The second C is covert intelligence. Joshua sends spies to check out the land, specifically the city of Jericho. And they are hidden. They are kept safe by a woman named Rahab, who has heard of God's fame and has changed to God's side in her heart. And she's promised protection when they conquer Jericho. She and her family will not be killed. And I would also like you to see the contrast between this episode and the previous time Israel sent spies into the land, back in the book of Numbers. This time, the people of the land are the ones quaking in fear. And the spies from Israel, they bring back a faith-filled report. "We can do it. God is with us. Let's take the land." Then the third C is consecration. In chapter 3, verse 5, Joshua says to the people, consecrate yourself, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. That is, they are to prepare their hearts, their minds, and their actions. They're to be set apart in holiness because God is in their midst and he's about to do great things in their midst. And then they cross the Jordan River, which is the fourth sea. And in this, Joshua is shown to be a leader of Moses' caliber by performing similar miracles. Chapter 3, verse 7 says, the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And then Joshua receives a reminder that God is still God. Chapter 3, starting at verse 10, says, this is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, all the otherites, etc. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now, God promises Joshua that the master of all the earth is on your side. Imagine what kind of confidence that would give to the people. The boss of everything is with you. Who can stand against you? He controls everything. How could he possibly fail? And the proof came when God miraculously dried up the Jordan River like he had dried up the Red Sea. And he brought them over the river, across the border, into the promised land. And they set up a memorial of God's miraculous parting the waters to bring them in, so that their descendants would learn the story and honor God. And then the first event the people did in the land was the circumcision of all those who had not been circumcised in the desert, the fifth sea. Now remember that circumcision is a sign of the covenant, and God required obedience to this sign. And the people celebrated the Passover in the land, exactly 40 years after the first Passover when they left Egypt. And the manna that had fed them for 40 years through the desert stopped, because from this point forward, they ate the produce of the promised land. Now, all these five C's are the introductory preparation for the main events of Joshua. The next main section is the conquest of the land by defeating the armies of the people who lived in the land. And the first target was the city of Jericho, right across the Jordan River. Now, you may have heard the old song, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down. Don't worry, I'm not going to sing. But I want to point out, to be perfectly accurate, Joshua didn't fight the battle. God did. Jericho was defeated by God's power, not the power of the army of Israel. And this was made very clear to Joshua before the battle even began. In chapter 5, starting in verse 13, it says, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, are you for us or for our enemies? Neither, he replied, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? The commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place you're now standing is holy. And Joshua did so. And it goes on. Now notice the similarity to Moses' call, where he was commanded to take off his sandals because he was standing on holy ground. And I love the answer the angel gives when Joshua asks, whose side are you on? He says, neither. See, God is on God's side. And Joshua was shown He could not presume God was on his side, but Joshua needed to get on and stay on God's side. It's a different way of looking at it. It's God's mission. And Joshua and Israel are blessed to be a part of it, and they're helped as long as they stay on God's agenda. But it's also true that God will be against them if they go off onto their own self-focused, rebellious, sinful agenda. And that's an important lesson for all of us. Don't presume God is on your side, but do all you can to get on and stay on God's side. Don't ask God to be a part of what you're doing, but ask to be a part of what God is doing. Then the people march around the city for 7 days. Now, this is not magic, and we should not try to imitate this and somehow try to manipulate God to do something. But what this was, it's symbolically claiming the ground for the rightful king. It's a triumphal procession. And as they finished doing this, the walls of Jericho fell down, and the Israelites captured the city. And Joshua is commanded to give the entire city to destruction, except for Rahab and her family. And the entire city is destroyed. They're told to take nothing for themselves. And then the next target was the city of Ai. And they went, but it turns out they went with presumption, even though they didn't know this yet. But a man named Achan had sinned against God by keeping some of the stuff of Jericho. And because they went against Ai without God being on their side, or without them being on God's side, they were beaten. Because God demands a holy people. Remember, stay on his side. And this is a classic demonstration of Deuteronomistic theology. When they are disobedient, they lose. But they do, they cleanse the sin by giving Achan over to destruction, the same thing he refused to do to Jericho happened to him. And then notice the recommission of Joshua in chapter 8, verse 1. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Go up and attack Ai. And then they conquered the city because God was with them. And then in the following section, they renewed the covenant with the ceremony commanded back in Deuteronomy chapters 27 through 31 between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim in the Promised Land. And in the ceremony, Joshua wrote out the Torah on the stone altar. And the Torah was read to all the people there in the Promised Land. And the next passage tells of a city that they did not conquer because they were deceived into making a treaty with them. And the reason that they were able to be deceived is given that they did not inquire of the Lord. They relied on their own wisdom rather than God's, and that never ends well. After these, the narrative then kind of kicks into high gear, summarizing in kind of fast-forward fashion the conquest of the land in three campaigns. First, they'd conquered the central part of the country with the first campaign, ending with the covenant ceremony. Then the southern campaign, to defeat all the kings of the south. And after that, the northern campaign, to defeat all the kings in the north of the country. And in each campaign, they were completely successful because God was with them, giving them the land by defeating the people who lived there. And then this section ends with the summary statement we've already seen in the key verses, that they had taken the entire land and they had rest from war. Now, it's important to realize that in Joshua, all the armies are defeated, but not all the people are defeated and kicked out of the land or destroyed yet. See, it's not complete destruction of the nations, but it's a breaking of the armies. It's not yet completely taking all the land, but they're taking over, they're in charge. Now, a modern parallel is the recent war in Iraq, where the U.S. defeated the Iraqi army in just a few weeks, but never conquered the entire country. Now, what this means is that for Joshua and the following generations, there's unfinished business for God's people to complete the conquest, to completely get rid of all the people from the land and all their idols and all their way of life. And this is going to play a part in future books. But for the most part, the land is subdued so that the book of Joshua can rightly say that the land was conquered. Then the next major section I've labeled Divide, because in this section, they parcel up the land for each tribe and family of Israel. First, there's actually a list of the land still to be taken. Then it reminds us that the land east of the Jordan was already given by Moses to 2.5 of the 12 tribes. Then people are sent out to survey the land. And when they come back with a description of the land is divided up by casting lots. In other words, each parcel of land is assigned by random chance so that there's no unfairness, and God is ultimately responsible for assigning each inheritance. And then there's a detailed list of inheritance tribe by tribe. And the inheritance of two individuals is specifically mentioned, the inheritance of Caleb and the inheritance of Joshua. Remember, the two faithful spies. And then special mention is given to the cities of refuge for those who are innocent of murder, so that they can go there and not suffer revenge killings. And then specific mention is also given to towns given to the Levites. The tribe of Levi does not get an entire tribal allotment because they're there to serve the Lord in the sanctuary. Chapter 13:33 says, "But to the tribe of Levi, Moses had given no inheritance. Yahweh, the God of Israel, is their inheritance, as he had promised them." Now, in terms of inheritance, the other tribes got a parcel of land, and the Levites got the Lord himself, and it seems like the Levites won the inheritance lottery. So then all the conquered land is assigned to the tribes and families that would permanently live there. And then the last major section describes how Israel then dwelt in the land. The eastern tribes return home across the Jordan. There's a bit of a misunderstanding as they built a rival altar, but it is cleared up. Then Joshua gives his farewell speeches. And he basically proclaims Deuteronomistic theology. He says, "Remember God and be faithful to his commands, and it will go well with you in the land. But be warned, if you don't, you will regret it." And Joshua reiterates the covenant, and there is a covenant renewal ceremony where all the people of the land recommit their faithfulness to their relationship with the Lord. And then finally, the book of Joshua ends with three burials. First, Joshua dies and is buried. Then they bury Joseph's bones, which they had brought back from Egypt. And finally, they bury the high priest, Eleazar. Now let's look at the theological themes of Joshua. The first theme is the transfer of leadership. Joshua is clearly the leader of Israel after the death of Moses, and he's confirmed by God in numerous ways. But this also raises a question. Who is the leader after Joshua? This book actually doesn't answer that question. And the vacuum of leadership will cause a problem, as we'll see in the next book. And the second theme of Joshua is holy war. Now, because the idea of holy war is often misunderstood, and because there's another religion that has an idea of holy war, let me try to clarify what holy war looks like in the book of Joshua. Holy war in Joshua is not like holy war in another religion. Completely different thing. A couple of things to note about the book of Joshua. First, God does it, not Joshua, not the Israelite army. God is the only one who can make holy war. And Joshua is just following through, being a part of what God already initiated, what God is already doing. Remember, God is on God's side, and God is the primary actor in the wars of Joshua. And I hope I don't need to say it, but I'm going to say it. That means we don't get to wage holy war. God does it. And second, it is made clear that the people who were destroyed deserved it. In other words, it's made very clear that the destruction of these nations was deserved, was right, was righteous. And God is the one who decides who deserves it. Now, we know from archaeology that it's been confirmed how bad the Canaanites and the Amorites were. I mean, even by modern standards, they're bad. And God held off the conquest, it says, until they reached the full measure of their sins. In other words, it just got to the point of no return. They had to be destroyed. And this is just the working out of Deuteronomistic theology. They were wicked, and they received the just reward. The third thing about holy war is that it was to protect God's people from idolatry, to get rid of those people and their way of life so that Israel doesn't fall into it. It's similar to the idea of a quarantine. If a nation is so infected with idolatry, God's going to insist that they be separated from his people so that his people don't become infected as well. You know, if somebody's leg has gangrene, the doctor cuts it off so that the whole body doesn't die. And these people were cut off from the land so that God's people didn't follow them in their idolatry. And then finally, what happens in Joshua, it is not genocide. See, Rahab and those who converted, they're spared. And it's not about race. It's about religion. It's about being for or against God. Any Canaanites, Amorites, anyites you want that are going to know that he is Yahweh are going to be blessed. Remember, those who bless Abraham are blessed. Those who curse are cursed. Now let's move on to the third theme, which is inheritance. The people possess the land, and it is their gift from God as an inheritance, which is then passed down to the same family as long as the people are in the land. Then the last theme of Joshua is God's keeping of his promises. And I hope that's self-explanatory. But I want to say again, take it to heart. God can be counted on to come through. Of course, it might be tested. It might take a while, but God never fails. And those are the themes of Joshua. Now let's review. First, the organization of Joshua. The four sections are intro, conquer, divide, and dwell. And the theological themes of Joshua are transition of leadership, holy war, inheritance, and God's promises fulfilled. Use the word thing as a memory aid to help you remember the themes of Joshua. Kind of nice how that worked out. Well, this is the survey of the book of Joshua, where God fulfills his promise to give them the land. Now, will they live happily ever after in the land? Well, why don't you stay tuned to the next section, where we're going to examine the book of Judges, and you'll find out there. Thanks for watching.